Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this Teneo Insights webinar. This month marks the first anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. The world saw the full horror of Derek Chauvin kneeling on his neck for 9.5 minutes, saying he couldn't breathe while pleading for his life and his mother. The event was a sickening outrage that demanded justice, but it also pricked the conscience of the world, with many realizing that we had not come as far as we thought we had in terms of racism and wider diversity and inclusion issues such as gender, disability, sexuality, age, nationality, and social class. Among all the protests, business was quick to accept that more needed to be done. Cynics say it was a familiar tune, with many previous proposals to improve things failing to get off the ground over the years. But has business improved its diversity, equity, and inclusion in the last year? Has all that desire to make things better made a real difference, or are we still struggling to do more? If so, why, and what should be done? And how do we make sure we don't lose some of the passion to make a difference that came about last year? As ever, we've got a perfect panel to answer these questions. Van Jones is a CNN presenter, author, and lawyer who will give a view from America. Alexandra Moussavizadeh is an economist and partner at Tawsis Media in London. She'll present brand new data from the Responsibility 100 Index, which Teneo sponsors, on progress by FTSE businesses. Sarah Sands is the former editor of BBC Radio 4's Today and the London Evening Standard, who will discuss her role as chair of the G7 Gender Equality Advisory Council. And Lord Mervyn Davis should be well known to you all as a Teneo senior advisor. As a former CEO of Standard Charter and Minister for Trade, he championed diversity, equity and inclusion, continues to do that in his many roles, including chairman of Letter One. But before we get to that, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you have a question, please put it in the chat function at the top right of the screen, and I'll put your questions to the panel in the second half of the call. And I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, apart from Van, of course, please hang up now. This isn't intended for separate publication or broadcast. Alexandra, I want to start with you because you've got some fresh data that should help us frame this discussion. Please tell us what you've been finding by analysing the FTSE 100 on DE&I.
Thank you so much, Craig. I think that I just take a step back, if I may, and I'm going to share some slides, just two, I promise, just about what the Responsibility 100 Index is. To give a quick overview and then dive into the fresh data, as you say, that we just published 2 weeks ago and zero in on the things that we're finding in terms of the ethnicity representation data and also on disability and gender and zero in on that. But just a very brief overview of what the Responsibility 100 Index is. And I'm very aware that there are a lot of indices out there and it is a slightly crowded space, but what we were trying to do with this index was create some urgency and help create some urgency within the debate around the direction of travel and the speed of travel with which, in this case, the FTSE 100 is moving. So what we did is that we looked at what companies are saying they're doing versus how they're performing against their you know targets and commitments that are made. So we look at a company's talk versus its walk, and measure across 52 indicators and a number of pillars that are here. You can see justice, climate, good business, equality, skills, and poverty and well-being. And what we're trying to focus on is the actual performance of these companies. We also look at the direction of travel. So we look at the change that companies are making. So for example, Unilever, that sits at the top, has the eighth biggest carbon footprint, but actually sits quite well in the index because the change it's making from iteration to iteration is quite big. So that's how that gets rewarded in this index. We also try and reward companies for reporting and transparency. So companies that report on all of the indicators that we have in our index that are sort of generally speaking quite standard, I think these days, get rewarded for reporting on them. And then we follow the performance of that indicator. But I think if we just go to the next slide, the general sort of theme is this index is now in its third year and it's the sixth iteration. And while we find that the sort of changes are quite slow, We have seen since our October edition and until this April, end of April, when we released the following, the first one for 2021, we have seen some changes in, for example, the ethnicity representation and pay reporting out of the FTSEs. And while the reporting is very minimal, I would say, as you can see from these charts, and I'll go through them very quickly. For example, only 4 out of the FTSE 100 published data on their ethnicity pay gap, and only 12 on their ethnicity representation at senior management level. And 15 companies out of the 100 report on ethnicity representation across all employees. So that's not a lot of reporting on ethnicity pay and representation, but it is actually, even since October, there's been some change that we've seen that could be spurred by the increase in the understanding that this is incredibly important. So actually the top figure has doubled. So in the October edition, there was only 2 companies, and for representation at senior management level, it's gone from 7 to 12, so almost a doubling, and so on. It's still very nascent, and there's still lots to do. But you would also see that because it's not a mandatorily reported or required reporting indicator, companies are not reporting on it. And I wonder if it was mandated that companies should report on this, then you would see a very different picture emerging. On disability reporting is something that we've also taken a very close look at the FTSE 100, and that's even more nascent in its journey towards transparency on its performance, and only actually 0 companies report on senior management representation when it comes to disability. Just to give you a picture of the sort of early stages companies are in terms of reporting on disability, is that 8 of the 100 companies in the FTSE have reported on disability for more than a year. So that just tells you a little bit about how early stages there are on these companies are in this reporting. And just last but not least, I would say that on gender, which of course is something that is required reporting from the FTSEs, because of COVID, there was a holiday given on reporting on gender pay gap and representation, and 9 of the FTSEs decided to take that opportunity and not report, which also goes to show that if there is no mandatory reporting, it is often a preference to not do it, and it is also a year which has been very difficult to maybe gather data, and the data has changed a lot in this year. But as already 13 of the FTSEs weren't reporting for various reasons on gender, and another 9. So we're seeing that slippage in reporting, and that also means it's really hard to track the performance. But I think I will stop here and leave questions on the data and the index if there are further to the Q&A.
Thanks, Alexandra. There's certainly a lot of food for thought and discussion there. Van, it looks like in the UK, the progress of the top 100 companies in the country is pretty glacial. Does that feel like a similar situation in the United States where you are?
It does. And that can be discouraging, that people feel that this is almost a lost cause before you start, because you know there have been other times when we tried to push. But I think that's the wrong view. I do think something has changed. I do think that there was a time when this idea of diversity and inclusion was sort of a box checking exercise, something you kind of had to do because you didn't want to get sued here in the United States, or you had to do because your younger employees were clamoring about it, or your grandkids were. I think something has shifted where people really deeply get that we're missing out on a lot of talent. We're wasting a lot of genius. We're leaving a lot of market share and innovation on the table. There's some carrots here and not just sticks. It's not just guilt. People really want to do this. I think people are having a hard time figuring out how to do it. I think people are having a hard time. It's not just the recruitment. It's the retention. That's the challenge. It's You know, it's the difference between being able to get a lot of first dates versus being able to get married. That's not the same game. Those are not the same things. And what it takes to sustain a relationship, even once you get that first date, once you get the interview, once you get the person hired, those things are different. And often people at the C-suite level have not been promoted for having that set of skills. What is that set of skills? You're focusing on four things when you're talking about retention. It's all about investment. The investment of capital. You got to put money on the table in order to recruit top talent. You're talking about investment of training, really making sure that the training works for a broader set of people than maybe it has worked for in the past. You're talking about investment of time. It takes time to figure this stuff out. It takes time to give people that opportunity to stay in. But it mainly takes an investment in social capital. You have to understand that these ideas around belonging. I mean, who got taught belonging in business school? Who got taught empathy in business school? How you invest your social capital and make sure somebody feels seen and heard, and that it's a two-way street here in terms of how the adaption and adoption takes place. That's social capital. How do you do that at scale? How do you structure that in? Usually you have an interview when somebody comes in, you have an annual report, or maybe an annual review, and then the exit review when they quit. how do you structure in stay interviews, interviews to help people stay? These are the kinds of things we can talk about later. But I think people understand, hey, I want these relationships. That's new. They're even having some success at trying to get these first dates. But how you sustain that relationship, how you get married and stay married, that's going to be the ultimate determiner. And I think we've got to work harder on that.
Sven, very helpful. Sarah, you're on the G7's Gender Equality Advisory Panel. What are you seeing and discovering through that? And crucially, what are you recommending?
Well, one first thing is, which absolutely speaks to what Alexandra was saying about the tracking of this stuff. So the first thing I found out as chair is that, you know, there have been GIACs before, the Canadian and the French sort of particularly, and that the last Gender Equality Advisory Council came up with 74 recommendations. But no one could quite remember them now, you know, this year on. And so what I realize is that kind of most of the work's been done. It's just that that no one's quite held accountable for it. And so the, you know, best intentions, everyone signed up, everyone was tremendously enthusiastic. One thing I noticed about the Sherpa meeting, which is the sort of pre-meeting that I'm going to tomorrow, is that it's entirely male. And so I think sometimes, you know, the difference between theory and practice becomes visible. And so I think that's, so in a sort of overarching recommendation, it's some kind of legacy index, so that when we pass on to Germany, we're tracking that progress and hoping that there may be countries that sort of sign up as, you know, role models or exemplars of showing where there can be improvement, because we know what the sort of big themes are. We know that education clearly makes a huge difference, particularly for girls, and that this has been a catastrophic year for girls falling out of education. If they fall out of education, in many places, they immediately in danger. So we've got sort of three themes of education, eradicating violence, and empowerment, which often comes out of education. And there's a big drive on science, particularly, which is another thing that if you track, in the data, the two sort of very striking figures are, one is how few girls study STEM subjects, and particularly sort of computer science, you know, compared to the men, and that's particularly relevant to us because the council members seem to be packed with sort of female scientists as sort of role models. We've got Sarah Gilbert at our end. And that is something that they've noticed, is that that even once you get into this sort of subject, there are just ways that somehow women get lost in the pipeline. Back to what Van was saying, is that you can get, even once you've got the women in, you know, there are sort of various disincentives all the way through. And there may be things that you don't even think about. There may be small incremental things you can do. I'm sort of interested in Parliament, you know, the difference that was made when Jacob Rees-Mogg said we should get rid of proxy voting. And immediately a whole ton of women said, well, I can't be in the House of Commons at 11 o'clock at night, so I won't pursue this. So there may be sort of small things with disproportionate outcomes. So that's one thing particularly we're looking at, the Gender Equality Advisory Council, of kind of what works and what actually makes a difference, what barriers can you remove that just allow you to sort of unleash this potential. And some of it may be cultural, some of it may be economic, some of it legislative. The very dangerous suggestion that I'm looking at that came from the French was whether there's some sort of media charter where people talk about how women are portrayed, which I know won't go down well in many circles. But I noticed, for instance, in one of the papers today, there was a story about recruiting more women into the intelligence services. And it was illustrated with a picture of a sort of naked actress with James Bond sort of kissing her back and so on. I thought, no, I don't think that's what they meant. So I think that's the kind of thing you're up against. But I do notice business-wise that I've just gone onto the board of the Barclay Group. And so I had my induction yesterday, and I noticed that, you know, that as a non-exec, your primary responsibility is towards the success of the company, but that doesn't just mean shareholders. That now means, you know, to the wider community. So I think business does seem to be taking this stuff more seriously. I suppose the only final point that I'd make is whether business, in a way, is ahead of politics on this. That talking to a advisor this morning who'd been involved in Hartlepool and just said, you know, that still. You know, Brexit and Remain is there. It's become the culture war now. And actually, one thing on the culture war is, you know, real sort of backlash to being lectured on things like diversity and inclusion. So it may be that there's a bit of a sort of disconnect that I think, you know, one has to kind of work through on this.
Thank you, Sarah. Mervyn, you've been championing D&I for many years before it was even called that, from the very top of business. What are your reflections on this, particularly this thought about how it seems to be moving so slowly?
Well, I think I just want to build on what Sarah said, that actually I think politics is way behind. And I think that, you know, it's interesting to reflect on the fact that 58% of the cabinet went to Oxbridge, 68% went to private school. And we've only had 50 female, roughly 50, I'm sure the audience will know the exact number, but 50 female cabinet ministers in our history. That's just not good enough. I would argue that politics is behind. I would argue that business has made huge progress on the issue of gender equality, getting women on boards. I think it's just coming to terms, as Van said, with the ethnic diversity and disability. I think that corporates are getting it. What I would say is that if you're leading, whether you're a chairman, CEO, or an executive, and if you don't understand the importance of inequality, D&I, climate change, and these issues, then you're a dinosaur, and your company will not survive. Either the consumer will desert you, or your shareholders will sell your shares. So I think we've made huge progress, but the bar is rising. And I think the more pressure through indices and other things that we put on corporates, the better. But what I don't want it to happen or want to develop is we don't need 25 indices and a report and accounts or an annual report that is 750 pages, because then nobody will want to serve on the board of a public company. And in fact, the number of public companies is rapidly reducing and the private side is growing. So we've got to find the right balance. We've got to get transparency into the public company sector. But I do genuinely believe we're making progress, but we've got to keep the pressure on. But politics, so far behind business.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we had Kwasi Kwarteng on this call, our business secretary, and he was saying that the British cabinet has got far more ethnic diversity than any FTSE 100. And there was a story recently about that of all the 100 FTSE 100 companies, the top three executive positions, none of them were occupied by people of ethnic background. Now, that's
that may be right, but Craig, I don't know any walk of life where people talk about so much about what school they went to.
Yes.
I mean, come on. We're not in that, you know, people talk about that they went to Eton or whatever. The world's moved on. I if you work in a corporate, it's about your performance. And I think it's about values and it's about the culture of an organization.
We need
politics to have a different mindset.
But let me prod you. I mean, let's not get into the political versus business thing. But if of all the FTSE 100 companies, not one of them has got the top three positions occupied by somebody BAME, that is shameful, isn't it?
I think when we started the journey on women on boards, 21% of the FTSE 100 had never had a woman on their executive of their board or their board in their history. And now it's a very different situation. I think, and I'm sure Van would agree, the ethnic diversity, but also people of different faiths, backgrounds, etc. I think corporates understand the necessity for this. I do think there's going to be colossal changes. And finally, I'm involved in two organizations that have just appointed two new non-execs from an ethnically diverse background, and the first time in their history. And we did, the talent was out there, we just hadn't been looking hard enough.
Let me remind everybody that they can put questions in the Q&A thing. Van, I want to bring you in here, and going back to what Alexandra was presenting at the beginning, it seemed, and this is a word that's come up a number of times in the conversation already, is if you don't have transparency and you don't have exposure, then businesses will find ways not to do this, not because there isn't a will or whatever, but that they're not doing it enough. Do you think that we should be going out of our way to really expose businesses, or will they just run and not be public companies anymore, like Mervyn was suggesting sometimes happens?
Look, I think business leaders are cross-pressured. There are two different games that a business leader is expected to play. One is, I've got to be successful in the marketplace. I've got to increase my sales. I've got to expand. I've got to grow. If I'm not doing that, I'm not doing my job. And now suddenly there's this whole other game that seems to be a different game about empathy and inclusion and understanding and all this stuff. And I think right now some business leaders are And I think that what hasn't landed yet is that if you get the second part right, it's a rocket booster under the first. That's what hasn't landed, is that this isn't a distraction. This isn't something that somebody's going to beat you up if you don't do. This isn't eat your peas. This is the vitamin. This is the rocket fuel under all the other performance. And in fact, which we don't talk about enough, your inability to manage difference when it comes to race, when it comes to gender, is actually a canary in the coal mine for your inability to manage difference, period. Your inability to manage cognitive differences, as we were just talking about, educational differences, you're leaving a ton of value on the table. Now, it's very visible when you have no African Americans, no people of color, no women. So we can focus on that. But what it really suggests is that you may have a deeper problem in your company, that if you that we have a company that is unable to truly take advantage of the genius of the world, of the different cognitive styles, the different lifestyle backgrounds, that we're, again, I say, we're wasting a ton of genius. We're leaving a lot of genius at the door. And so all the work that you do to retrofit your organization to better take advantage of other pools of talent will shockingly also probably advantage pools of talent you already have that you have not been tapping properly. There are people in your organization right now who are not saying anything in your meetings because they know if they raise their hand, these are white guys, they're not raising their hand. Because they know they're going to get shot down. And so this is an upgrade in leadership competency overall. It's an upgrade in organizational performance overall, using race and gender as, you know, urgent proxies for probably deeper problems that need to be solved anyway.
Alexandra, I'm just interested in, since you've been doing this, you said that there's been 3 years and 6 iterations of it. How are you noticing that, you know, top businesses are reacting to it? Do they like it? Do they feel uncomfortable? Are they welcoming it with open arms?
Well, I mean, the companies at the top are very happy, but I think to Van's point on and to your question, Craig, I think, I mean, what we see is exactly that. If you get, there's a knock-on effect, right? There's a correlation between the companies that are doing really well in the index, that have really worked hard at changing the culture and the value set within the company across all of these aspects a long time ago. And you can see that the focus on transparency, the trying to, it's not just trying to do better on climate or inclusion, it's actually when the mindset is that we're really going to try and be as good as we can and contribute to the community we are operating in, and trying to make sure that our employees are listened to and well, you know, well cared for, and that we, you know, think about the, you know, the footprint we have in the world in terms of climate. That it's never in isolation. It's never that one company does really, really well on one thing and really badly on everything else. It, typically, what we see is that once you make that decision, you actually tend to do really well on all of the ES and Gs. So you do see that correlation between a real effort to change the culture and to do better on the full gamut. So I think that's sort of one aspect, and to sort of reflect on what Van was saying. And I think also just to pick up on what Mervyn was saying about the many indices out there, and it was something we were chatting about before. I mean, there's no doubt that there is a lack of taxonomy and common metrics that makes it incredibly cumbersome and tiresome for companies to have to report against all of the many indices out there. And that, as you were saying, the rating agencies are now also coming in, and you've got MSCI and FTSE Russell and Arabesque and Sustainalytics and now us also. But I think that it is to be expected, as it is more and more important, as we know, to report on these things. And as we were looking at how the financial reporting metrics back in the 1920s were in a similar situation in terms of no common taxonomy. There was many different ways to measure this or to measure financial reporting. And eventually it got wrestled down into a set of indicators that by and large most of the world adhered to. And I think we'll probably get there
I was going to come to Van's point about retention, which I think I saw you all nodding on that when it's a particular issue in the first dates versus a marriage thing. All of you, with respect, have been around a while. What are your views on retention and why it's been a particular problem and what businesses can do to ensure it happens? Sarah, let's start with you on that. You're coming off mute. You're struggling. Okay, let's flick to Mervyn while you work out your mute buttons there.
I'm sorry, I've got to mention COVID. I apologize. I think COVID is going to change working patterns. It's going to change working what you wear to work. It's going to change flexibility of work. It's going to change attitude to work-life balance. So it's you know, the world's gone on pause, and as we recover, it's going to be very different. So it's back to what Van and the others have said, is this issue of cultures and values in the company. And I truly believe to retain talent in the coming years, you will have to show empathy. You will have to show that you're sensitive to anxiety, mental health issues, et cetera, and that you really get diversity and inclusion. And if you don't, I honestly do believe that people will not stay with the company, because they're going to have a different attitude to employers after COVID.
Jared, where are you on this retention point? What particularly needs to happen? Because it is obviously such a problem.
Can you hear me?
Repeating back a bit. Try again, Sarah. Sorry, Van, do you want to expand on the retention point?
Yes, we were retaining some echo there, so sorry, I don't know what that was. Sorry for to the audience there. Look, I think it's critical, you know, here in the United States, Target, if you're looking for role models, I think there's two things here. One is the why, and the other is the how. I think people are catching up on the why, and I think we've heard repeatedly here today, you know, there are real benefits here. It's not just carrots, it's not just sticks, it's not just lawsuits and getting shamed on social media. There's real benefits here. The question is the how. Target here in the United States is a great company to look at. Optum is a great company to look at. There are companies that are getting this right. You know, you have you know, some of these employee retention groups where it feels weird to like let all the African Americans be in their own group talking. Is that weird? Is that racist? Is that bad? It actually turns out it's very good, because it gives people a sense of actual shared commitment to the company and to figuring out ways to make things better and to kind of working through some of the emotions so that people can be more constructive when they come forward with suggestions for improvement. But that could be very, you know, different. The other thing I'll just say is that you shouldn't feel bad if this is weird. If this is just, you weren't selected or promoted into the role you're in because you're great at this stuff. It just wasn't on the test. It wasn't in the prep materials. And so you're now in a situation where you're being tested and graded on something that, you know, is new. That should give you some empathy. The great thing about that is it's new for everybody. The great thing about that is we're all struggling to figure this stuff out. And unfortunately, for too long, there have been, you know, some groups at the top have been a little bit exempt from all this anxiety and all this agita. And so it's just been disproportionately borne by the women, disproportionately borne by people from different backgrounds. Now we've got some equality of discomfort. We've got some equality of anxiety. And in that condition, innovation is really possible, because now everybody's got some skin in the game and everybody can start to figure this stuff out. If you as a leader are approaching it in that way, this is sort of a little bit of useful challenge, a little useful humility here, and you're going to have to rely on other people to help you get great at it. That can be a very vulnerable moment. That can be a very generative moment in a company and on a team. So and that helps with retention. You don't have to feel like the boss gets it 100%. You have to get that the boss gets that he wants to get it, or that she wants to get it. If I get that you've gotten that you need to get something, that's enough. That at least we can stay in it together. If I feel like every time I've got to climb a mountain, a steep mountain in the rain with short legs, just to make the point, screw it. I mean, I got other things to do with my life. And so I just think, you know, it's not about perfection. It's just about realizing that we are in a conversation together that I don't have to throw myself on the train tracks every day to have. that somebody else is on the train tracks with me and that person's called the boss.
Good point. I just want to move this to very practical things now, because I think that, you know, we're all in agreement. We need to move this forward. It is starting to move, but maybe not as fast as we think it should. Could we all give some practical examples that we think businesses should just be doing straightforwardly, and that they should, you know, they should become automatic things that happen? So, Sarah, let's see if we've got the feedback situation sorted.
I hesitate, but does this sound all right?
You're fine.
So I suppose just from experience, thinking about the BBC was where I sort of saw it in action, and to Van's point about, you know, it's choppy when you see it. So I was there when the pay gap figures were released and caused, you know, absolute mayhem of people thinking of actually seeing how they were relatively valued. And some of it wasn't quite fair. And also you were sort of measuring something difficult, which is it's an intangible. It's the sort of showbiz versus the public service and so on. So you're trying to think, but a lot of it was shown that it was that pay was done in a quite a kind of cronyistic or unthinking or unsystematic way. So that was a big change I witnessed. The other thing I noticed at the BBC, and I'm now much calmer about it, but it's hard coming from newspapers, which are fairly authoritarian, you know, that the editor's word is, you know, is the final one, to a more sort of flat structure, a way of doing things. And at the BBC, as we know, you know, that anyone can complain. And what I hadn't quite realised is that most of the complaints seem to come internally. So, you know, actually a lot of them from Wales and a lot of them junior people. So, you know, suddenly your whole kind of authority is being questioned by very new recruit, usually from Wales. And so at first I got quite uppity about that, you know, thinking that I'm the editor here, you know, And then I found it actually, you know, once you get used to that, it's in some ways exhilarating, sometimes annoying, you know, but and it doesn't mean that, you know, just because someone's you know, young or diverse and they question you that they're necessarily right. So we have to work out those sort of relationships and actually what value you put on things like experience and but on the whole, it was, you know, it was a good thing. So I do think that new, you know, general sort of uncertainty. And the other thing that I've noticed, you know, going back into the private sector, and certainly here where I am at Hawthorne, is that the, you know, young people care about values, they care about social purpose, they want to know, you know, that they can believe in their company. It certainly isn't enough just to say, you know, you're being paid, you've got a job. So I think that new sense of wider responsibility, you know, is important. The other thing, I guess, which I've learned a bit from the Gender Equality Council members, is a very, very good economist called Iris Burnett. I don't know if you've had her at any of your sessions, but she's done a lot of work on attitudes at work and unconscious bias. And actually, once you start that sort of self-examination, because some of this, you know, can't just be done through regulation. It's, you know, it's deeper and it's more embedded. And, you know, for instance, Van was talking about people talking in meetings, you know, that they're Julia Gillard, who's another person involved in the council, had some research that showed that women speak less for very good reason. Because if a man comes up with an idea which is half good, half bad, people will tend to give him the benefit of the doubt and go, oh, well, no, that's quite interesting. With a woman, and there is some sort of data evidence to go with this, they'll tend to think, oh, that's quite a bad idea. And so it's in women's interest not to speak up, actually. You know, it's they're being totally rational by being risk averse. So when you're dealing with all these sort of intangibles, it's, you know, it's complicated.
Mervyn, you managed to just about contain yourself on the Welsh point.
Hello,
what are the baseline things that businesses should be doing to make sure that we're moving this forward?
Look, I have to come back on the Welsh, Sarah. You know, as a Welsh speaker, and I spent the last week in Wales, I'd like to congratulate all my Welsh colleagues on harassing you. I remember one boss turning to me and saying, "You've got two problems as to why you're not going to succeed in business." And I said, "Oh, why is that?" But firstly, you're Welsh, and secondly, you're short. And it shows how time's moved on. I do think, looking at the questions as well, I think it would be a very good idea to force chairman of every public company in America, but in the UK, to, in their chairman's statement every year, to have a section, paragraph, whatever you want to call it, on diversity and inclusion and the journey the company is on. It would be an easy fix. It would be something that companies would be willing to do. You don't need to do a lot of changes, the Companies Act or whatever, but we should, on the whole journey of getting women on board, we did name and shame companies. We did. I did use journalists like Sarah and others. We did use the FT, and we did name and shame the companies that weren't adhering to, you know, weren't sort of moving fast enough. So I think on D&I, I do absolutely think the chairman of the board of directors should make a statement on it every year. And I think that's an easy thing to implement and to spread the word. And particularly in the US and the UK, where we can say, look, let's get it done by the end of this year, every company. And it could be for large public, private companies as well. If I may, digress to one other thing, which is around talent. You know, we've lived through such uncertain times, and we've also got a digital revolution going on, and we've got the whole climate change debate. So I think the youth of today in the corporate world, they value the values and purpose and, you know, culture of a company much more than previous generations, as Sarah and Alexandra have mentioned. So now is the opportunity for companies to differentiate themselves. And I think that leaders, that they have to embrace these issues. And if they don't, I think the talent will leave.
Van, I think in America they use the term table stakes, don't they? They're kind of the things that just need to be on the table in order for you just to play in the game. What should the table stakes be on this for businesses? What practical things should they be absolutely have to do in order to be considered taking this seriously?
Well, I mean, I mentioned some of it in terms of, you know, just at a practical level, the problem isn't at the top. Often the CEO may have sat through enough of these things that he or she gets it. She's certainly looking down the barrel of, you know, consumer, you know, naming and shaming. There's some funds now in the United States and pension funds you can't even access anymore if you're looking for investment or capital if you don't deal with some of these issues. The problem is two or three levels down, there's some person who feels that they're barely hanging on in their present role. They're middle management. They're trying to manage a bunch of young people below them who, whether they're from Wales or wherever they're from, they sure are aggressive and they sure talk funny and they sure think they know everything. And you don't even know if you can discipline them without getting blown up on Twitter. And then you got the boss, you know, you come to work and you look on your phone and the boss has put out some statement about all this stuff that's going to happen and, you know, talking about all these issues and stuff in the news that you may not even feel the same way about. And now you got to go to a meeting. You're like, what the hell is going on here? How that person is respected and addressed and recruited and brought in is going to be make or break you. And I don't think we think enough about that middle manager. How is this whole change a win for her and not just a bullseye on her forehead? For the CEO to come and smash on her for not doing a good job and for the people below her to eat her alive. A lot of this stuff that seems like resistance and seems like intolerance or whatever is a lot of fear and grief that we haven't figured out how to manage in the workplace for the old incumbents, for the people who, because of where they went to school and because of who they know and because of what their dad and mom did for a living, they feel that they're supposed to be there, and now suddenly the ground feels very shaky. We tend to want to blow past those people and say, you guys just don't want to own your privilege and this kind of stuff. But, and then that's half of it. But the other half of it is people are scared, and people are grieving for changes they didn't sign up for. And I think that you have to understand how change hits people as a leader. Even change you want. I've got a 17-year-old son. We've been trying to get his butt, you know, potty trained and good at reading stuff. And he's going to be out the door this time next year, God willing, barring any tragedies. He's going to graduate. He's being recruited by Stanford and Dartmouth. Everything we want is about to happen. We will be crying like babies when he graduates. We'll be broken down like you can't believe. I don't know if we're going to survive it. And that's change we wanted. That's change we signed up for. That's change we've been fighting for. Change is terrible. Change is hard. And so if you got to have empathy across the board, and we've got to do a better job now of getting middle managers to sign on and understand, here's your chance to be the hero. Here's your chance to be the shiro. Here's your chance to be the difference maker in expanding the pie for everybody. This is not a win-loss. This is a win-win. We got to be much more emotionally intelligent in how we recruit that lower level into this game. And that's something that I don't know that anybody's doing a great job with, but I would say that would be the leadership challenge. This thing is breaking down now at the middle management level. The CEOs are brought on board. But that's the challenge. And you asked me for something practical. This is something I'm just now beginning to understand. I don't have a practical answer for it, but I would say that's the challenge.
That's a good answer. Let's take some of the questions that are coming through. I'll give this one to you, Alexandra. Kate Sandler is saying, how do the panel feel about justice and equity being included within a diversity and inclusion discussion? I mean, I think that the question really is like, are we broadening this too much? Is that something that you'd want in your R100?
I mean, in terms of broadening it to...
Well, it's gone from, you know, starting with issues in terms of race, moved to and gender, and now it's diversity, equity, and inclusion, and justice, and things that are being added. I think the question is, things keep being added. Is that okay? Is that helpful, or does it mean that we end up so broad that we don't focus?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it is. I mean, obviously, from the index perspective, we try and measure all of these things in the index. We tackle it in terms of the way we weight things in the index, right? And what is most important. I think the risk of being too broad, and sometimes it's also all of these aspects are so important. And from our perspective, we've included that and climate and equality and poverty and well-being and all of that goes into the question of being a responsible and accountable company in today. But I just wanted to go back to the practical question that you asked, if that's okay, Greg, before. And I think what Van was saying was so important with the challenge. And I really think that is a very hard one to respond to. How do you respond, and how do you put something practical in place, change the culture and the challenges that a middle management, profile that you were highlighting? How do you address that? But I think it comes back to what Mervyn was saying in terms of statement, because I do think yet that it is important that the leadership does get it. And I think it is important to put those statements out. And in the UK, you see companies that are signing up for the Parker Review, that are signing up for race in the workforce, or the work charter, and making sure that companies do commit to that. Because I do think at the end of the day, if there is a commitment that's made, that is stated, that is put on the website, that is in a press release, that is on a third-party website, that this company has signed up to these commitments, And if they then don't do it, and that is all through, you know, reporting, to creating a different culture, to having, you know, to having a culture and a place where these things can be discussed internally, right, and changing not just sort of the external expression of these things, but also what happens internally. By signing up to these things and putting these statements out, employees and stakeholders outside will hold the company and the management to account if it doesn't happen. And I think that's really, really important.
So we've got just, we're coming towards the end. So some quick answers, please, if that's okay. Getting a couple of questions about credibility. Some people saying that, you know, you have to fill in what's your race, and you have the option to say, prefer not to say. Other people saying, you know, managers that have just tin-eared getting it wrong. Mervyn and Sarah, do you want to just talk a little bit about credibility? And then there's one final question I want to ask you all.
Well, if I may, just very quickly digress a little bit, which is, we had an era of companies being all about EPS and quarterly earnings. Then we had an era of they needed to do that, but they also needed to do CSR. And today we're in an era where the bar is rising, that you've got to show that you're not just making your EPS, but that you know the purpose of your company, that you are paying the fair amount of taxes, that you're doing, you know, that you're a great corporate. And if you're not, then you're going to be slammed. So I really do believe that that is the essence of what we're talking about. It's the purpose of a company, and it doesn't matter whether it's a large PE-owned company, an investment company, a family office, or a public company. I think that the mandate for these businesses is now much wider. So I'll pass on to my fellow Welsh lover, Sarah, on the direct question.
In my defense, that, you know, I work with John Humphreys, yes, I'm blameless on Wales. I don't know why I upset those people in Wales. I would say that, you know, back to my experience, I guess, of the of GIAC, is that we're sort of clear on the aims. It's now how we get there. And one thing I've asked for is as much work as I can, because we've got you a big report for September, which is the best practice. And I think that's the kind of key to all this, of what works, and where people are trying something that has made a difference. So I think that's, I think it's all got to be sort of evidence and data from now on.
Don't worry, Sarah, we're not going to report you to the Welsh Equality Commission. I just want to come to the end of this, because we've only got a few minutes left. And we started this because it's a year since the murder of George Floyd. I wonder, each of you in turn, try and give some sense of, have we made real progress? And if we have this conversation in a year from now, will we still be saying the same old things, or will we've made even more progress? So Van, if that made sense, I'll start with you.
I think we've made progress, if nothing else, at the heart level. Kate has been asking a question in the Q&A about, you know, this idea around justice and equity. You know, that's a tough one, because, you know, obviously when a massive, horrific thing happens, you do want people to respond. At the same time, a corporation can't respond to every injustice in the world all the time. Otherwise, you can't do the rest of it. So when does something rise to the level that a corporation wants to respond to the externals? And then on the, and there needs to be something, you know, clear about that. But then on the inside, what's the level of understanding we're aiming for? Do we just want people to get along well enough so that we can, you know, make more money together? Or is there some deeper level of understanding and empathy and insight about some of the structural stuff that goes on? That person who's sitting next to you in the cubicle, that person who's, you know, the next picture to you on a Zoom call, how different is their life? How different is their kids', you know, journey to school? How different is their experience? And how meaningful should that be to you? These are the deeper questions around justice, structural understandings. And I think that the companies, you know, to Mervyn's point, the companies that, you know, take that on more and more as just a way of understanding the world, I think will be rewarded in the marketplace. It's not just you're going to be punished if you don't. I think you're going to be rewarded if you do, because you're going to suddenly see opportunities for change. You're going to see tweaks to the product. You're going to see whole vistas of innovation available. I don't think we're going to be having exactly the same conversation in a year. I'll put it this way. I don't think we're going to have the same conversation in a decade. It's a year, sometimes it's hard, but I don't think a decade from now we're going to be having this conversation. I think we'll be having a much deeper and richer conversation for the firms that survive. And I think the firms that survive will be the ones that are having this conversation now.
Mervyn.
I think I look back on my personal journey, I've got a much greater awareness of the importance of Ramadan to Muslims. I've got a much greater understanding of faiths, the different faiths, which I've been on a journey of learning. I think we all have. And I'm a very different human being and a very different attitude on some of those issues too, because I just know more than I did maybe 20, 30 years ago. I think it's the same on this issue of ethnic diversity. I'm now so aware of the issues and the injustices and the stuff that is wrong that is going on that I'm now a campaigner. You know, I'm one of those campaigners in the same way that I run my businesses differently because I have a greater understanding of faiths. So I do genuinely believe that the nature of the debate has changed. And I think on the marzipan layer in a company that doesn't get this, you have to stamp on them. And that's true on technology, you know, technological change as it is on this. You have to be tough on them.
Alexandra, in a sentence, do you think the R100 is going to have moved a lot in a year?
Not a lot in a year, as to Van's point. These things are structural and they take time. But just to very quickly, I think that COVID has had a big impact on our empathy, actually. I think there's been a lot of mentions of empathy and how empathy can shift a company's culture sort of across the board. And I think COVID has meant that we really have focused on our teams to make sure that everyone was okay. And it's a sense that I get, I can't see it in the numbers, but it's a sense that I get across the companies that we've been talking to very closely in this update, that has emerged. There's a mental health understanding of how people are doing, understanding, you know, many things that have surfaced that that we as you know, colleagues and bosses have really needed to focus on, has, I think, will emerge out of that with something really good and a much better understanding generally on all of these things. And therefore, I do hope we'll see a more rapid change in the data that I track.
Sarah, this will be familiar to you. You've got 10 seconds.
I would just say, look at Line of Duty, you know, which is our favourite program and was a sort of model of diversity and inclusion. So I think if it can start with popular television, the rest can follow.
Well, thank you. We're right up against time. I just want to say thank you to a fantastic panel. Thank you, Van, as well, for getting up very early in the morning in California. It was great to have you. Mervyn Davis, Alexandra Moussafadeh, and Sarah Sands. You were a great panel. Right now, everybody's giving you a virtual standing ovation. Thank you very much for joining us for the last hour.